Your Partner in Success Radio is a free business podcast with host Denise Griffiths. It's all about great stories, conversation, and context to help you move your business and life forward with actionable tips and advice from her guest experts. To listen and subscribe, just find us on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume your podcasts.
Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and today I get to welcome Jessica Onager. She's the author of an Amazon best-selling book, Imperfect Courage, which I happen to have on my desk. She is the host of the podcast Going Scared and mom of three. So in 2010, Jessica and her husband Joe needed a way to raise funds to adopt their son Jack from Rwanda. And while they were on a trip to Uganda, the Onagers met, I hope I'm saying this correctly, Jalia, J-A-L-I-A, and Daniel Montavu, who created beautiful handmade goods, but they lacked a stable marketplace to ensure their livelihood. Jessica saw a solution to both of their problems by selling the jewelry, the Montavu's jewelry, back in the U.S. She could raise funds to adopt her son while simultaneously generating revenue for this really motivated couple. So the overwhelming reaction to the story and the products propelled Jessica to turn her at-home fundraiser into an actual company, and Noonday Collection was born. Now, Jessica's innate desire to create meaningful opportunities for others, paired with an unwavering passion for social entrepreneurism, that's a tough word to say, has earned her notable accolades, including 2015 Person of the Year by Austin Lifestyle Magazine, Tribeza, and in 2017, she received the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year Award. I'm having trouble talking today. It's going to be a fun interview, I think, which recognizes entrepreneurs who are excelling in areas such as innovation, financial performance, and personal commitment to their business and communities. Her story has also been featured on top-tier national business and lifestyle publications such as Inc., Today Parents, and Forbes. Jessica, good morning. Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, listen, we have been having all kinds of trouble, just so the audience knows. We were having technical difficulties. I'm trying not to cough all over you, and it's almost Christmas, so let's just relax and have fun with it.
Hey, I'm going to light a candle sitting on my office desk, and we'll just, you know, have a fireside chat.
Perfect. Absolutely. Did I just cough on you? I hope I did not.
You're good.
Okay, I think I did. I'm trying to hit my button. It's one of those days where it's like, okay, something good is going to happen, and you are my something good. So anyway, before we get going here, and I do have your book. Thank you so much for sending that to me. It's a tremendous book. But tell people a little bit about yourself that I just didn't get in there that you think is really important.
Well, probably an important fact is that I am a mom, and that is really what led me to start this business. I had given birth a good old-fashioned way to two kids. My husband and I had two children and knew we wanted to grow our family, but really knew there were other ways to have children, and we began to explore those other options and really landed on international adoption. He and I actually met when we were working overseas for a non-governmental organization serving the world's most poor. And we had always wanted to have more of a multicultural life, and international adoption just really made sense for our family. But when we made that decision, it was right during the recession, and we were about halfway through the adoption process, had even identified where and who and all of those things when the recession hit, and we were no longer able to afford the adoption expenses. So Noonday Collection really was my solution to solve a financial problem. At the time, I thought it was going to be just a little fundraiser, but now it's grown into a global business that is impacting the lives of the poor in many countries, and then as well as many women right here in America, empowering them to launch their own businesses.
And I have to ask you, because so many people are very, very interested and very passionate about creating their own business, their own lifestyle business, if you will. And, you know, they have something like this. It could be a fundraiser. It could be something. It could be quilting. It could be anything. It could be something they're very good at, they're very passionate about, and they're going to find a way to get it out into the world. So I'm dying to ask you this. So when it went basically global, because you said that it was going to be, you know, just a fundraiser, which just is not the correct word, but it was going to be a fundraiser, and then all of a sudden you're impacting people all over the globe. What did that feel like, and did it startle you or scare you, or have you going, oh my God, this is wonderful, or all of the above?
That's a great question. It really started, I was so bent on getting my son Jack home from Rwanda that I was just hair on fire selling these goods. I was selling goods made by women in Uganda and then Guatemala and Ethiopia, and I kept adding more countries, really, you know, able to better serve my customer who was wanting different accessories and different materials. And as I kept doing these trunk shows, I would go into other women's homes and I would ask them if they would invite their friends over, and I would sell these goods to their community. I realized that there was a hole in the market, that, gosh, this business was fulfilling a purpose for me. I had been a little bit purposeless since, you know, my husband and I met while living overseas. Then we came home and I did real estate and I did China sales for a little bit for wedding China, and so many of my odd jobs didn't feel really connected to my purpose. And so suddenly now I'm having so much fun styling women. I'm having so much fun connecting with women. And then I'm becoming this storyteller on behalf of the artisans I'm partnering with. And I'm getting to create impact, direct impact in these very economically disenfranchised communities. So I would say my moment of true terror came when I did realize it was time to scale, that this business was working. It had traction in the marketplace. I'd reached $100,000 in sales in, you know, just the first few months. And that is when I realized, what am I going to do to scale? I'm not operational. I don't have a finance background. I knew I needed help. And I began to reach out to different friends and eventually brought on a business partner who we bootstrapped the company, and he lived salary free. He said, I'll go salary free. I'll live off my savings and let's just see if we can really scale this idea that you have. And that's what brought me terror, because at first it was me, myself, and I, and if it failed, you know, I'd be out of maybe a little bit of my reputation or a little bit of money. But when someone else was taking a bet on me, that is what really made me realize, okay, I am being cornered by courage right now. And that's really what I found in my journey, is that when we link our success to someone else, it enables us to commit and take the long view, which we need, because entrepreneurship is daunting and it is filled with ups and downs and failures and successes. And you've got to settle in for the long ride, or you're going to stop too early and not really see the fruit of your idea, you know, bring traction, create traction.
And, you know, what you just described is a daily event for us. We're, you know, we're up, we're down, we're like, oh, this is a great idea. Oh, crap, what was I thinking? I mean, it's constant. And I always tell people, if you don't have a cast iron stomach, this is not for you. You've got to hold to your vision and find the help wherever you can find it. But you're right. Once you take on a partner or somebody, you know, thank goodness in your case says, oh, look, I believe in this so much that I will live off my savings, I would be in the bathroom crying, going, oh my, what have I just promised this person? It would be tough. But you have to do it. You have to keep going.
Yeah. If you want to scale, if you want to take, and that's kind of what was apparent to me. You know, I think a lot of people, you brought up quilt making, or, you know, sort of these lifestyle passion businesses. My business really is more of a life mission, and it's not a lifestyle business for me. In fact, I'm living a lifestyle that, I have a beautiful house and a beautiful family, but, you know, I mean, it's it's the day before Christmas and I'm at the office, like working hard, and I have very limited ownership over my schedule, and I've got a lot of commitments. So for me, it wasn't so much like, how can I create a business that brings in enough money to kind of give me the lifestyle I want? It really was, I want to scale this. And scale, you know, can come with a cost, and it can come with a huge learning curve. I mean, it's been a huge learning curve for me. But again, the vision is so much bigger than just me and even just my business partner, Travis. It really is for us. We're building a flourishing world in these places that are often disenfranchised. And, you know, we have linked our success to our artisans. And, you know, we took it one step further and launched the ambassador opportunity. So I knew I was experiencing so much joy and so much purpose in this newfound job I'd created. I knew there were other women out there like me across America that could also benefit from having a flexible side business that would also connect them to their purpose. So that's when we enabled other women to launch their own Noonday Collection businesses. And we now have 2,000 of those business owners around the country. And the irony is that for them, it really is a lifestyle business where it is, you know, flexible and, you know, a great earning potential and connects them to their communities. Whereas, you know, I'm living more of a corporate lifestyle at this point because I'm running a company with 60 employees and a whole lot of stakeholders. But that's okay. That's okay. I'm having fun doing it.
It sounds like it. And you never saw this coming, did you? When you, and what I wanted to do, let me preface that question with another question. You had mentioned that you were doing trunk shows, which I think is brilliant. I'm an introvert. I wouldn't do it, but I really appreciate other people who are willing to do that. Do you mind walking through just a bit of how you started this with going into people's homes and, you know, just kind of walk people through some of the steps you took so they can go, oh, I can do that?
Yeah, I mean, it really was not rocket science. I had these beautiful handmade goods, so I was connected to the makers in Uganda, and I originally opened my home one night, and that, again, was, I thought, was going to be a one-time fundraiser. I had these African-made goods that my friends had connected me to because my friends were living in Uganda and wanted to create an artisan business for some of their Ugandan friends, and they had said, why don't you try opening your home one night, sell these goods, and maybe you can use that profit to help with your adoption costs. They knew that we were in a hard financial times. So I opened my home one night and women came, and I just saw such an amazing response to the power of women gathering. So just, there is something about human connection, you know, getting women together. There was power in getting to try on beautiful accessories that were handmade and carried this soulful story. And there was just a lot of appreciation for women getting to use their purchasing power for good and getting to have transparency around how their dollars were then creating opportunity for others, but in this really fun way. And so I knew that night that there was traction just by seeing the experience that was taking place in front of me. So the very next day, I texted my friends back in Uganda and said, can I get more of this product? And they said, absolutely. So then I got more product from them and began curating product from other artisan businesses, either through connections I'd made because I'd lived overseas before, or I don't know, other really random. I mean, I look back and I'm like, this is so much bigger than me. It was obvious there was some divine story writing happening because I just was able to connect pretty quickly to these other artisans that were supplying me with their goods. And then I just simply asked women to open their homes, you know, and a lot of people said yes, and some people said no. And if they said no, then okay, well, do you want to buy something? You know, you don't have to open your home, but would you like to purchase? And I was couch surfing in strangers' homes. I began driving all over Texas, but it's a really simple thing. And I think what I discovered is that women really do want to show up. And, you know, I think especially for women that enjoy hospitality and want to just have an excuse to get a few friends together, it was also answering a problem for them, you know, and it was being a solution to them. And And that's really how it grew, just from one house to the next.
And see, listening to you, Jessica, I'm thinking this wasn't just an underserved market. It was almost an undiscovered market.
It was, yeah. At the time, there, you know, the direct sales model is as old as, you know, Tupperware. So in that respect,
I was thinking about
you know,
that. And what's that other one that everybody does right now? It's not Tupperware, but it's something else. I'm always invited to go. I said, can you just send me a link? I'll buy something from the link. I can't remember.
Yeah.
But it's a very popular plastic type of thing. It'll come to me midnight tonight.
Oh, yeah. Let me know because I don't know. But yeah, and I myself had, you know, so many people that were a part of those companies who said, Jessica, you'd be such a great salesperson. You should sell for, you know, whether it was cosmetics or even other jewelry companies. And I'd never been interested because the product wasn't connected to something bigger. So I realized here I am having this flexible job, getting in women's homes. I do love meeting new, I love connecting. I'm not like some crazy extrovert, but I do appreciate connection and I very much value in-person connection and social connection, I think, is a huge solution to the increasing depression and anxiety rates that we see today. And my business in a way has facilitated connection in a way that has really helped women even to overcome depression. I've had women tell me about, you know, being especially postpartum depression, and it gives them this reason where they've got to get up and get out of their house. And then they go to these trunk shows, these gatherings of women where they get to style, but they also get to storytell and connect women to women all over the world and really show up as this global sisterhood. And it's very empowering, which really can ultimately be life-changing.
It sounds like it. And I'm fascinated by the kind of start and then how you just, it just kind of came to, it sounds to me, and I know nothing is as simple. I'm an entrepreneur, solopreneur, and nothing is ever simple. We can make it sound like it was just a piece of cake. It never is. So don't let anybody fool you. But it sounds to me like there was a spark of divine here. I mean, you started the process. You were doing it for, you know, a very good reason to adopt your son. But then it sounds to me like it just went step after step after step after step because it was almost meant to. You're helping people all over the world. You're helping people here in the United States. And, you know, it sounds like a win-win all the way around. That being said, what were some of the moments where you just went to yourself, what the heck am I thinking? You know, where you had moments thinking, or did you have moments thinking, this isn't going to work and I just bit off more than I can chew? I do that all the time, by the way. Then I get over it.
Yeah. You know, I have felt that more as we have scaled. I would say the beginning years, I am such a big visionary, and because I had lived in these areas of the world that really needed empowering solutions, you know, not charity, but actual job creation and entrepreneurship, that is just such a huge, huge driver for me. I'm also a huge supporter of anti-human trafficking efforts. And there are, you know, where there is poverty, there is often exploitation in the workplace, whether that's through human trafficking or whether it's through, I mean, there's modern day slavery, even still something called bonded servanthood, where a person might get a loan and then in order to pay the loan back, they work, but they never are able to make enough to actually get out of the loan. So it's a certain type of modern day slavery. So all of these things I've been so aware of and yet often felt a little bit helpless. If anything felt overwhelming, it was that like, oh my gosh, like how can I be a part of the solution to some of these huge issues that are so at present in many places in the world? And that's what burned me more than anything. And so when Noonday suddenly became this really viable solution to help create opportunity, economic opportunity, which then really disrupts modern day slave trade, and it then prevents people from getting into situations of human trafficking. That is what has always driven me. And then I think it's as we've scaled and as we've run into when we over inventoried one year, and I, you know, being someone who had never really overseeing inventory and merchandising and planning, you know, that was a real learning experience to, you know, be stuck with $1 million worth of product. You know, all your cash is king, and it's all tied up in these products. And how do we get rid of these products? And then how do we, you know, work with our social entrepreneurs to help them kind of understand how that supply chain works? So I think the main times I feel like I've bit off more than I can chew is when I'm put in situations as a leader where I'm having to maybe communicate hard news, or even if I'm having to let someone go. Those are the times when I just feel very, oh my gosh, like I wasn't made for this. Why, you know, like anything that's like painful, which I mean, you know, when you're growing something that's been 9 years now, there's going to be a lot of pain along the way. Those are the times when I'm like, oh, this is hard. This is so hard. And I've had to really dig into and learn what it means to be emotionally resilient, which I write a lot about that, and Imperfect Courage, and my discovery of learning to be vulnerable and to lean into friends and to really reframe failure. You know, these are things that I'm still learning every single day, but I wouldn't trade these lessons for anything.
Well, and that's just it. They are lessons. I mean, they may smart at the time, and you're walking around scratching your head and going, oh, my. Or, you know, something a little bit more pithy. But, you know, they are lessons, and they're good lessons. And you said something earlier about, you know, modern-day slavery. The indentured servitude has been around forever. This is nothing new, and it doesn't seem to really go away. So I really like that you're working towards that and helping other people. I think that's amazing. And for our audience, grab this book, please. You know, grab the book. It's called Imperfect Courage. I've been reading it for the last couple of days, and Jessica, you ought to see it. It is just chock full of little sticky notes, because I don't like to mark up a book. I really don't. What I tend to do...
Oh, really?
I don't. When somebody gives me a book, most of my author, you know, podcast guests do, as such as yours, I have to open the book. It's critical. I have to open the book. But I will also go buy the Kindle version if it's available, and I can mark that one up all I want. And then, you know, if there's something really critical that I want to remember, I will send it to myself. You can email whatever it is that you want to keep, and that way I've got this list of things. Okay, go back to this one. And so Kindle and the hardback, I'm always happy with both. But I wanted to ask you very quickly, Noonday Collection, what does that mean? Where did that come from?
So when I was trying to figure out what to name my business, this is after that original gathering at my house that night, and I realized, you know what, I think that this is more than a one-night fundraiser. I think this could really be a business. Of course, a business needs a name. And I'd always been drawn to this passage in scripture in Isaiah 58, where it says, when you satisfy the needs of the oppressed, your night will become like the noonday sun. And just that idea of brightness, of warmth, of being in the middle of the day and taking that moment to experience sunshine and optimism, that really resonated with me. And I was sitting there, I remember I was on the dock out at my in-law's lake house, and I was, it was this very metaphorical moment where I was thinking, am I going to dive in? You know, am I going to jump out into this lake and really make this a business? And I decided on Noonday, and right then I picked up my phone and opened up my emails, and I opened up an email from a friend who was living in Ethiopia, and he said, I have not talked to you in ages, but I've been thinking about you a ton lately, and this scripture came to mind. And it was that exact scripture, Isaiah 58. And so that was my little clue, my sign that I was meant to jump in. And so I did.
That is a lovely story. And, you know, I have found over time, you know, if you're paying attention, if you're paying close attention, that these moments that seem serendipitous, they really are showing up for a reason. And my thing now is, if I hear the same thing 3 times in a row, I throw up my hands, put my pen down, say, okay, I'm paying attention, and I just go into this kind of I wouldn't call it a meditative state because I have a squirrel brain and I don't really meditate well. But I dig and I poke and I listen and I try to figure out what the message is. I don't even ask anymore where it's coming from or why. I just pay attention to it. And then off I go. Do you do the same?
Hello?
Are you still there? Did you hear anything?
I am. Are you there?
Yeah, I am.
I did. That was.
I wonder
weird.
What happened.
I don't know.
We're having issues, but we're working through them.
I did pick up a little bit. I heard squirrel brain and meditation, which I can relate to both of those.
Right, but what I wonder what happened. What I think I said, because I do this all the time, I just get to chatting and they'll say, "Oh, repeat that." I can't. I don't know what I just said. But my point is that I will do the same. You know, if I hear something that just comes along, it's not just serendipity. It's like, where's this coming from? And then I hear it again, or I read it again, or I see it again.
Yeah.
At that point, when it is about the third time and it's just kind of hammering, you know, the big sign over your head, pay attention, I stop and I pay attention. I will stop whatever I'm doing. Doesn't matter how important it is, unless it's a conversation, that's important. But I will make a note and go right back to it and just shut everything out and say, what's the message here? What am I supposed to be doing? I don't ignore those things any longer.
Mm-mm. Yeah. Yeah, you know, there's something so powerful about simply paying attention. And I think, you know, what we become what we pay attention to. And that starts in our minds. And if you can learn to quiet your mind a bit and learn to be a listener, you know, and realize, gosh, pay attention to the people in your path and the experiences in your path and the moments in your day that are trying to tell you a story. And I think often simply by paying attention, we can step into our purpose.
And that is so true. It took me the longest kind of time to figure that out because I do have a monkey brain. It just doesn't ever settle down. So I'm dying to ask you, you've got to have, with all the work you've done and the people you've met, what are some of the best stories you've heard? And if you don't mind, share some of the ones that just had you going, oh my gosh, I don't know what to do. You know, this is not a good story. Do you mind sharing those?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the original artisans that I partnered with, they were named Jalia and Daniel. And they were my original suppliers for all of these beautiful Ugandan-made pieces. And so this was the couple that really launched Noonday Collection. And they were, I had some of their goods at my very first trunk show at my house before it was Noonday. And then I began ordering from them. And as it turns out, they were extremely poor, abject poverty. They didn't have food to put on the table. They would go and dig in their neighbor's yard for potatoes to eat in rural Uganda. Their kids were in school. At one point, Daniel had to go and his favorite object was his leather-bound Bible, and he had to go and sell it in order to get money to have dinner that week for his family, to sell the leather from the Bible. And they now, today, have 100 full-time employees. They have two cars and a beautiful home, and their employees now have a daycare, a scholarship program. They celebrate birthdays, and Jolly and Daniel have a real, because they have come from poverty, they have a heart to hire the most vulnerable people in their community. And so those are the stories that are usually very profound to me. Many women who have been kicked out of their homes in Uganda, there are land right issues where it's called land grabbing. So if a husband decides to divorce his wife, or if a husband dies, then the husband's family can literally just come and kick that wife off of their land and out of their house. So there have been situations where an artisan that works for Jalia and Daniel has been kicked out and left with nothing except their four children. And there's this one story of this one woman, Nakato, and this was a situation she found herself in, and she came to work, you know, just in tears and distraught, and what am I going to do? And throughout the day, different of her coworkers would come and either give her cash or would say, here's a fork, here's a spoon, here's a blanket for you. And it's because of her work community that Jolly and Daniel established that she was able to rebuild her life again. And there's many stories like that, stories of redemption in Guatemala, where the women that we work with in Guatemala are in this very rural, isolated part of the country. And there are very few economic opportunities for people in general in this community. And then for the woman who is mainly the caretaker of the child while the man goes off and works on coffee fields, you know, we've seen how this job has enabled a woman to be able to stay at home while still being able to hand bead all of our handwork at home and out earn her husband. And because of that, she's been able to send her child to school, or children to school. So again, yeah, so many stories of impact. And, you know, the CEO of Gallup did, you know, he's done thousands and thousands of polls all over the world. And he said his biggest discovery is that what the world wants most is a good job. What people want most is a good job. And that's a profound, it's a simple thing, you know, but it's profound. And in many places in the world, there just simply aren't good, dignified jobs.
I'm listening to this, and I have to tell you, I had no idea that, you know, that kind of law or rule or behavior happened in other countries. I mean, you try that here, and the woman's probably going to meet you with a shotgun and say, get off my land. I mean, we're just not going to allow it for the most part. But, oh my, I mean, my heart just dropped when you started recounting that. It's horrible. Is there any chance of that
being changed?
Well, it's cultural.
And, if you think about it, in the U.S., it used to be, you know, the land belonged to the man, you know, so it's a little bit of that same concept where the law in Uganda is mutual land ownership, but it's the cultural phenomena that still is being perpetuated. And yes, we actually work with an organization called International Justice Mission, and they have a community of lawyers in Uganda that is working on this issue specifically. And because the law is clear, the law says that that's not legal, but most women, when this happens to them, they have no access to an attorney and no money to pay for an attorney. And frankly, since it's so cultural, they don't really maybe even know their rights and that it's actually, you know, that they do have a right to this land. So a lot of times it is partnering too with other organizations that whose, you know, International Justice Mission is, their purpose is really to redeem and reform broken justice systems.
That makes me happy. I know you say that today the brand supports dignified work for 4,500 artisans in 15 countries, impacting over, 21,000 family members? That's astonishing.
Yes.
And again, this is not,
it is.
This wasn't your thinking when you first started out, but you know, the brand has just gone from strength to strength to strength. What, and that leads me to, you know, wanting to know, what is it that people are providing for you? I mean, I've looked at Noonday and spent a little bit of time in there, and there's some gorgeous, gorgeous items in there. But part of me wonders, okay, how did these women learn how to create these just incredible, this, you know, gorgeous, gorgeous work? And how do they find the money to buy the means to create these things? I mean, that kind of, I was like, okay, if they're this poor, where are they finding the money to create this stuff? That's always been a question for me. Because you said that, you know, this one gentleman that you first started working with had to sell his Bible. Did he ever get that back, by the way?
He didn't get it back. But, you know, one of the ways we do business radically different than traditional retail is that we pay for our product upon purchase order. So we are able to pay long before we even receive the goods. And so they're able to have operating capital to purchase raw materials and pay their artisans. And in order, you know, eventually maybe they're able to have that cash flow to run their businesses. But we act a little bit as a microloan bank in a way with our artisan partners. And then as far as the talent goes, I mean, it really varies from country to country, because in some of these countries, these, like for instance, in Guatemala, hand beading and weaving in particular has been centuries old. I mean, this is the Mayan people, and they have been hand weaving their own clothes for centuries. And what we're doing is we're almost safeguarding that heirloom, that technique from going extinct. We're preserving this heirloom weaving technique by making it appealing in the marketplace, and then therefore the younger girls want to continue to learn it. Usually you get your first backstrap loom when you're about 10 years old and you learn how to weave. That is just your rite of passage as a girl into womanhood. And you know, it is a dying art in a lot of areas in Guatemala. And so we are simply coming alongside a lot of these artisans who have been working on certain techniques for centuries. And then we're just creating a broader marketplace for their goods by introducing maybe color stories that are a little bit more appealing to the Western marketplace. Or maybe we're combining some materials and techniques that have never been combined before. So we're really the ones that get to be on the receiving end of just these really, really talented, talented artisans.
I love what you said about heirloom, because so many things that come to us from other countries, we consider them heirloom because it's not something we can produce here. They're so beautiful. We want to put them behind glass or up on the mantle, or, you know, just put them somewhere where they're very safe. I mean, they're almost, I don't want to say sacred objects, but they're so very different from what we're going to get from Amazon, right? That they become important pieces in our home. I have several of these things, not from Guatemala, but, you know, from American Indians. I have several pieces like that. I don't play with them. I put them where they are safe, mm-hmm. where I can see them and where I can really enjoy them. But I don't play with them and I don't let anybody touch them. Do you find that some of what is being sold on Noonday is the same way? It's treated as an heirloom?
I do. Yeah, I do think it is. I mean, we are a fashion brand and fashion changes, so we're very, a lot of our things are very trendy. But, you know, so many of our things are so, they're imperfect by design. The materials they come from are so unique. Seeds from Ecuador. And, you know, we work with a goat leather group in India where it's all vegetable tanned and it just ages so beautifully over time. And, I mean, I've been at it 9 years now. And so I have some of our first Noonday pieces that I'll still wear and enjoy. I think there's just something about handmade that makes something special and worth holding on to.
Oh, absolutely. So when you're talking with some of these artisans, and I'm sure you're spending a lot of time with them and your team is spending a lot of time with them, what are some of the things that you are finding that are the most important to them? Yes, they need a good job. Yes, they need to make a living. But let's move to the emotional and family and spiritual side of it. What are they really getting from you?
Well, I think, you know, again, when you are making something and it's beautiful, and you realize that there is someone on the receiving end of that that feels also dignified and beautiful. I remember the first time Jalia came to the United States and to our first, one of our sales conferences where ambassadors come and they gather and learn sales strategies and styling ideas. And she came to that. It was at the time, it was a couple of hundred women and everyone was wearing her beautiful handmade goods. And she said she got it then. She said, oh, people aren't just buying this for charity. This isn't a handout. Women are actually wearing the stuff that we're making. And
she thought it was a handout? That's interesting.
She didn't think it was a handout. She thought people were buying this product to be nice, but that it was sitting maybe in their closets.
Gotcha.
And so when she saw that it was actually contributing value, real value, to women across America, and now, of course, we're in Oprah Magazine this month, and we've been in W Magazine and Southern Living, and, you know, when she's been able to see the Today Show, when, you know, held, Kathy Lee Gifford held up one of Jolly's beautiful necklaces one morning on her show. And so when Jolly's been able to see, like, this is beautiful, this, you know, that actually really brings value to the maker. And so there is this idea of, sure, like economic empowerment and, you know, basic human needs that we all need, that many people around the world just don't have. But then there's this meaning and empowerment that comes from a job where you're creating something that's of value to somebody else. That feels really good.
Absolutely. And I can see them working away and, you know, selling their goods to you that you've already paid for, but not really understanding where they go or why people love them. They're just doing their work. But when they can see, as Jalia did, how people are actually responding to this, I think that makes a huge difference probably in how creative they get and how much harder they probably work. But they're now doing it for themselves. They're doing it for their family. It's not just putting money on the table. They're doing it for a much larger purpose, I would think. That's what I'm hearing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I think we all want to be contributors. We all want to know that our job matters and that we can create, we can be a part of something bigger too. And I think that's the beautiful thing about our stakeholder model is we ambassadors actually get to earn trips to go visit artisans, and artisans come to our annual conference every year. And it's this beautiful stakeholder model where the ambassador is looking into the artisan's eyes saying, thank you, because of you, I have these beautiful goods to sell that matter to my customers. And now I've been able to do things for my family that I couldn't do before. And then the artisan, you know, is saying, well, thank you for selling my goods, because now I have this job that is creating opportunity for my family. So it truly is when, you know, we're leaning onto one another. We truly need one another in this model for it to work.
No kidding. Will you ever start working with artisans in the United States? I'm thinking Indian reservations. Do you have any interest in that, or is this basically across the world?
We have looked into that. I mean, we're always open, absolutely, to that. So if you have any connections, you can send them our way. When I first started, we worked with a small group of refugees that could tat and crochet, and I would sell some of their goods, but as it turns out, they really wanted a stable, consistent job with health insurance. And so when we got big enough, we actually were able to hire them to be on our fulfillment team. So now they have health insurance and they work in our home office, but not as artisans, but as part of our team.
But that makes sense. And, you know, I figured that might be the case, but doesn't hurt to ask. Listen, let's move to your book now, because it's a fascinating book. So what would you like to share about that? And thank you again for sending it to me. I'm really loving this. And just for our audience, the book is called Imperfect Courage, Live a Life of Purpose by Leaving Comfort and Going Scared. Let's talk about going scared, because, oh my gosh, if you are an entrepreneur, solopreneur, and you're not scared about, you know, at least a third of the day, you're doing something wrong, as far as I can tell. And I don't mean, you know, quivering under the couch scared. I mean walking around going, what did you just do? What were you thinking? Oh, I can fix this. It's okay. I mean, we all have those moments. If we don't, we're a little bit too cocky.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I think that is the challenge is, you know, that when I look back to that first night in my house, and I was about to have a bunch of women come over, but I was so afraid no one was going to come. I was afraid I would feel rejected. I would get rejected. I was afraid of what people would think if they did come, that here we were in this financially horrible position and I'm having to sell things and, you know, in order to bring my son home and all of those things. And, you know, I think that that's when I learned that courage is not fearlessness, but courage is simply being afraid and going anyway. And, you know, I'm not really scared of rejection like I was then anymore, but certainly I'm scared of other things now. You know, I think about, gosh, we are so high stakes now. Now we have, you know, it's not just me and Jalia and Daniel like it was that first, you know, couple months. It's now thousands of artisans, like you mentioned, and thousands of family members. And now we have all of these ambassadors here in America, too, who are counting on our brand to be a highly sought after brand, because that makes it easier for them to sell and get inside women's homes. So I just try not to focus on my fear anymore and really, you know, instead of looking at the problem, really being solution oriented. And of course, the vision of building a flourishing world is what drives me every single day.
And doesn't that feel right to you? I mean, it's, listen, I have met people who they're going to build a business and they're going to do it by their Excel spreadsheet and they've got a goal and they've got a plan. And I try to tell people, look, plans don't work. Goals do. Plans are meant to blow up, and they're going to blow up probably by noon. So, you know, don't worry about your plan. Worry about being flexible and agile enough to work around that plan. But don't you find that by just going with what feels right to you when you're building your business, obviously you have to have everything else in place. You have to have the money, the advisors, you have to have the, you know, you do need to have some kind of a business plan. I'm not saying discount all of that, but it sounds to me like you go strongly with your gut. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs, solopreneurs, most of us do, at least that's been my finding. Is that true with you?
Yes, it is. I think so. I think I'm a big believer in identifying opportunity and possibility and moving in that direction. And certainly there have been many movements throughout my life, even before Noonday, where I can see that's been true. And I think that is what an entrepreneur does. An entrepreneur sees opportunity and possibility and then is able to come up with a solution that helps not just them, but, you know, usually it helps a whole lot of other people as well. And I think you always have to be looking for that possibility and believing that it's there. I had a meeting this week with someone who leads a huge, I mean, large real estate organization, and it was encouraging meeting with him because he's been working with his company for, you know, 15, 20 years and is still seeing new possibility and new opportunity in the marketplace. And I think that's what's so exciting, you know, is that there's always something you can do differently or something that you can do better to drive a different result. And that's what keeps me engaged at my job for sure.
I love that. Well, let's hit some of the high points in your book. How did you come to write this book?
I really didn't have a lot of guides as I started Noonday Collection. And I was a mom of three kids at this point, and I didn't feel a lot of support. That's not true. I was being supported. I didn't have a lot of other people in my life who were startups who were also parenting. And I looked to books to help me. So Brené Brown and Sheryl Sandberg and Tina Fey. And these are some of the books that really helped me to not feel so alone in those early years. And so I knew that, you know, I wanted to be able to give back in that way. I wanted to be able to share some of the experiences and lessons I learned. Books have been a huge gift to me, so I wanted to do that. And I think there's also something really powerful about getting the story in written form. I mean, we basically have, you know, franchisees, right? Franchisers all over the country. These women who I, you know, am saying, here, take this opportunity and go and make it your own. And I think when you have a book, it really enables you to have that culture. You're grounded in the same story. So now we're all grounded in the same story. And I think that brings power and it brings some consistency to the brand story as well.
Exactly. So when you started writing this book, listen, that's always something. I think we all have a book in us. I really do. But for for some reason, when it comes time to write that book, I don't know about you, I've got two different books started. And right now, one of them is an epic blank page. That's all that's on it. It's just a blank page. It's in my head. I just can't seem to get it onto paper, but I will. So did the book kind of have you going, do I really have time to do this? Or was it something that you just had to do?
You know, it was a business play for me. It wasn't this, oh my gosh, I have a book in me, and if it doesn't come out, like, I won't be able to sleep at night. It was really more of a, I got a great book deal, and that money we were able to use to market and further build our platform for New Day Collection. And so many people discovered our brand because of the book and still continue to discover our brand for the book. So it was just simply a way, instead of putting money into SEO or Facebook ads, we put money into, we really didn't put money into the book because the publishing company did that, which is great. So that was just another way that was being opportunistic, because I thought, okay, we don't have some big marketing budget. We've grown organically. So how can I get someone else to pay for the marketing? And I thought, well, I can get a publisher to buy a book deal. So it's very entrepreneurial. I'm just very opportunistic and, you know, continue to try to see everything through that lens.
And that makes perfect sense to me. One of the books that I'm attempting to write is being done for exact same reason. I need to draw attention to what it is that I do and how it can help other people. So I completely understand that. So when you're writing this book, what are some of your favorite stories? You've got one chapter called Step Into Your Story. Let's talk about that a bit, because some of us don't. It's, you know, just, I think so many of us, we're just clocking along. We're going okay. We're doing, you know, everything's fine. Sometimes we don't realize that we have this massive story that we really should be sharing, because it's fun, it's horrible in spots, and it can be massively inspirational to other people. But I think a lot of us just don't recognize that. So let's talk about your story.
Yeah, I think that, again, I love that you said we all have a book in us, and I completely agree with that. And even if you don't want to write a book, I think it's so worthwhile to just simply spend time thinking about your story. I did this recently with a life coach with my husband, and we went through a pretty quick exercise where we talked through our story from when we met until today, and then we defined these key turning moments, these moments that were that created a pivot in our lives, or it created a new way for us to see something. And from that, it created a new way that we lived. And we almost created a little bit of a storyline and life chapters of our marriage. And, you know, it's been helpful for us, because then you're able to look and see, gosh, what are those common threads in my life? And, you know, what does that mean for my future? And where have these turning points, you know, led to me to have an impact on other people? So I think that is really what has been, so helpful. So, writing a book is just, it's extremely helpful.
I keep telling myself that. Can you remind me periodically?
Yes.
I have a big reason why I can't do it every single day. I'm busy. I'm really busy. I'm tired. I don't want to do it. Nobody wants to hear from me. I mean, we go through all of this nonsense, and it is nonsense. I mean, just call it what it is. If you've got something to share and you think it will definitely help other people, for crying out loud, share it. Write a blog, write a post, talk to people, just share it.
Share it.
I find that with
this
podcast, when talking with people like you every week, and I'm so honored to do this every Friday, I get some of the best ideas, and I find friends, I find people to network with, I find people to refer to other people. I wouldn't stop doing this for the world. And it's not something I ever thought to do. I just started doing it. Now I wouldn't miss it. I mean, I wouldn't miss it for the world.
Yeah. It's so fun. I have a podcast as well.
It is.
It's such a gift to get to sit and interview other people. You learn so much.
Yep. You do, you do. And listen, I live in a very small town, southwest Louisiana. I'm 15 miles from the Gulf as the crow flies. Honestly, I get to meet people all over the world. It really is a gift.
Mm.
So we've got about 5 minutes. Is there anything that you want to share with our audience that you think is important or fun or uplifting that maybe is not mentioned in the book or, you know, that they just don't know about you?
Gosh, we have covered so much. But I would say, you know, one of my favorite chapters in the book is called Stop Trying. And it really is about commitment. And when you have a commitment to something that matters, you take the long-term view. And if you're taking the long-term view, you're also going to take time for the things that matter. Because in order for something to be sustainable, you do need to take care of yourself and health and exercise and time with my family and time with my friends. You know, I just certainly hope that those are on your listeners' priority list. They aren't extra fluff, but they really do contribute to, at the end of the day, higher productivity, because those are the things that end up filling us, is that human connection. So I think that is just really, really important. And ultimately, it's what my business model does. And if you're listening to this and, you know, you're wanting to start a Noonday Collection business, you know, we would love to have you. You can hop on over to noondaycollection.com and, you know, tell me you're interested in becoming a Noonday entrepreneur. And you can also follow me on Instagram. I'm super active on Instagram at Jessica Honegger. And you can even DM me there if you have more questions, or if you want to just open your home for some friends and open your home to these women of the world, to Jalia and her artisans and to Daniel. We would absolutely love that. We are looking for women who want to gather and want to gather for good.
Excellent. Well, where can people find you on the web? I mean, you just mentioned a couple, and I do follow you on Instagram. I love what you're doing over there. Where's your website? Where can they find your book? You know, just let people know where they can locate you.
Yeah, so noondaycollection.com is our business hub, and we have a great blog on there. And then you can follow me on Instagram, and it's Jessica Honegger. That is 2 G's and 1 N. And I also have a website, jessicahoniger.com. My book is available on Amazon and anywhere where books are sold, and it makes for a great gift. It's a beautiful, beautiful book, too, if I don't say so myself. And you can also find me on Facebook as well, Jessica Honegger, as well as Noonday Collection. And my podcast is called Going Scared, and that can be found on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts, Going Scared. And we're doing a really great series in the new year that's going to cover wellness, mental wellness, food and body wellness, and business wellness. So we would love for you to hop on over to find me over at Going Scared as well.
Definitely. I've been listening to you. It is terrific. I'm looking forward to that, because something most of us do, many of us, and I've caught myself doing the same thing, we get so busy taking care of business, taking care of family, taking care of everybody else, that at the end of the day, we're like, I didn't go walk today. I didn't really take care of myself. So we've got to pay a lot better attention to how we are doing internally, physically, emotionally, if we want to be of service anywhere else.
Absolutely.
Jessica, thank you so much. It's been wonderful speaking with you, and I thank you for all of the wonderful advice that you shared with our audience. And I want to apologize to you and the audience for coughing on you and for all the little tiny glitches. But nonetheless, I think we had a terrific conversation, and I really appreciated you being here today.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful. Have a wonderful holiday.
Oh, you as well. Before we say goodbye, I would like to remind our audience to be sure to look for us in iTunes and anywhere else you consume your business podcasts. Just look for Partners Radio and take us along on your success journey. Thank you.
Get your voice heard. If you would like to launch your own far-reaching podcast, contact Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com and go to the podcast tab.